Welcome to Hot of the Cloud by Cloudonaut. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig.
Our weekly show is all about the latest AWS news and our recent experience building with AWS. On top of that, we are answering your questions at the end of the show. So use the hashtag AskCloudonaut on Twitter or send us a direct message via LinkedIn. In case you're watching this live, feel free to use the chat to ask your question. So, Michael, this is a special show because it's the first time I'm streaming from a new office. I'm really excited about that. It's also the reason why this back looks a little bit boring because I didn't move everything yet. So still in progress, but my streaming setup is already in place. So happy to go live from this new location today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and this should fix our latency issues in the stream. So if you watched the stream before and you had problems, so this was because of us, not because of you, and it should be fixed now in the new office.
Right? Yes, hopefully. One more thing I want to announce before we start, which is we have released the third volume of the Builder's Diary. So the Builder's Diary is a series where we talk to practitioners and learn from them. And in this episode, I've talked to Rico Nugit from Demicon about infrastructure pipelines with GitLab and Terraform Cloud. So this was really interesting because he's using a whole different approach than I've been using. So I was really learning a lot from him. Especially about Terraform Cloud. So yeah, check that out. You'll find the links in the show notes. Michael, so then I think it's time to dive into the AWS announcements. And as we didn't have a show last week, this is basically a roundup from the past 2 weeks. So we don't pick every news item, every announcement. We pick the ones that are out of interest to us. Let me start. So the first one I found is introducing Amazon Neptune Serverless. So what is this about? So first of all, Michael, did you ever use Neptune before?
Nope. I mean, I used Kraft databases, but not Neptune. So I used Neo4j, but yeah.
As you said, it's a graph database. So basically, it is about storing relationships between items and also analyzing and query them. And so I think, yeah, it's an interesting service. It goes in that direction of use the right database for the job. So that's basically what Neptune is about. So now they have a serverless offering. So this sounds great. And I had a little look into it. So first of all, I think important to notice is that Neptune Serverless is not available in all regions. It's only available in 6 regions. So stuff like US East 1, US West, EU West 1 and 2, and Northeast Asia Pacific 1. So yeah, it's rolling out slowly. And then how does Neptune Serverless work? It is a little similar than Aurora Serverless. You also basically define so-called Neptune capacity units. And the database basically scales automatically upon based on the demand. And it scales from 2.5 Neptune capacity units to 182 Neptune capacity units. So this is something between 5 and 265 gigabytes. So that's the range the machine scales out of the box automatically. So this sounds interesting, and I remember that I did a review of Aurora Serverless version 2 a few months ago. And one of the findings I had is that the pricing is really, I would say it's a little strange. I don't understand the way they price for those services. So I had a look into the Neptune Serverless pricing as well and tried to compare it to the on-demand pricing. So Michael, I don't know, what would you expect? So what would you say, what should serverless cost compared to on-demand? How does the service need to be priced so that it makes sense to use it?
I mean, for me, it should scale down to zero, and then it should cost nothing besides the storage. And it should be definitely, like, if I'm not running at 100% utilization, which usually I don't do, it should be cheaper than the on-demand version. Yeah?
You plan for your peak workload, right? So you provision, let's say we provision 16 gigabytes memory. That's the thing we need for our peak workload. I don't know, doing once a day, the workload peaks to that, mm-hmm. or once a week or something. So we provision for that. So my assumption is that now when I compare an on-demand instance with that capacity to a serverless instance with the same capacity at peak level, it should cost me less in case I don't have a utilization of 100% all the time. So that's what mm-hmm. serverless should be about, right? But the interesting thing is, and I did a calculation and basically tried to visualize and calculate the provisioned price compared to the serverless price in relationship to the idle period of the database. So I'm starting with an idle period of 1%, and I'm ending at an idle period of 100%, which means an instance that does nothing all of the time. And what it's important to know is that Neptune serverless needs a minimum baseline NCU of 2.5. So it doesn't scale to zero, similar to Aurora serverless version 2. And then I put in the numbers and I couldn't really believe my eyes, because when I compare a DBR6G large instance with serverless, so with the same configuration basically, both with 16 gigabyte memory, it turns out that there's no scenario in which the serverless one is cheaper than the on-demand instance. So I really don't know if I'm making a mistake. I really tried to go through it multiple times. I couldn't find my mistake. Only when I use a larger, much larger instance type, for example, the R6G 2X large, then there is a sweet spot somewhere when the on-demand instance idles more than 80% of the time, then the compared the same serverless instance gets cheaper. So this is really, I don't know, it's not really looking to me as a competitive offer, the serverless compared to the on-demand. Maybe I'm missing something, so tell me in the comments, but I really tried to figure it out and that's what I ended up with.
But like one question, the assumption is that you always run with the same like NCUs, right? The capacity units.
No, that's the thing. That's a really simple example, of course, because I assume it's either utilized at 100%, so running at, or it's basically 0%.
Okay, so when you say idle, then this is basically going down to this 2.5 NCUs.
Actually, it is very similar with the, it's not that worse with Aurora serverless version 2, but there's also my big concern was about the pricing. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's really a thing, Neptune serverless. Let me know if you're into it, but for me, it doesn't look like a competitive offer.
The one that I looked at in more detail, the news that I looked in more detail is, titled AWS Web Application Firewall launches challenge rule action and bot control for targeted bots. And so just by looking at the title, I basically had no idea what this is about. So I have no idea what the challenge rule is, and I have no idea what bot control for targeted bots is, or what even is a targeted bot. So turns out that what they call a targeted bot is basically, for example, when we run cloud on auto.io, we have people out there that kind of go and just copy all our content in an automated way. And that is a kind of targeted bot. It is kind of developed for the purpose of getting our content from the block, kind of. And the tools that you can use for this is, for example, I mean, there is this very old school tool called Selenium, but there's also Puppeteer. And the one that I used recently is... and now I cannot remember the name. It doesn't matter. Basically, it's some kind of headless browser automation thing that you can use to open a website and kind of act as if it is a real user. And so, for example, what I do is I kind of look at some pages and then I compare the ranking against others. So for example, okay, so, but this is a targeted bot. And what AWS WAF launched now is the following. And they also kind of restructured the whole offering a little bit as far as I see, because bot control was there for quite some time. And that's also, that's actually why I looked into this, because I tried out bot control when it was released and it was really super bad. So we enabled it for cloud and now that I own it, it really blocks lots of traffic from real users. And it doesn't block lots of traffic from bots. So it's, I don't know, it's not really working that well. And what they are now doing is, and they call this intelligent threat mitigation. And there are a couple of, I would say, capabilities under this umbrella. One is around detecting if someone kind of tries to log in like to lots of accounts and trying out passwords and things like that. And the other capability, and this is the new one, is basically the bot control for targeted bots. And what they do from a high level perspective is, you, if it's a website, it also works for apps, then it works a little bit differently. But if it's a website, you embed the so-called client application SDK. It's a, like, it's JavaScript. And what this JavaScript library does, it generates a so-called token. It is basically fingerprinting the browser. So it tries to identify the browser, and this is then added as a cookie. The cookie is called AWS WAF token cookie. And this is kind of passed on like for every request. And this is used by AWS WAF to kind of, it's kind of a session that they use. And then they do rate limiting on this token. So you cannot send more than, I think it's, what was it? I think I read somewhere that it's 5 requests or something like this. And then what they also do is they run a so-called a challenge. A challenge is basically trying to detect if this is a real browser. And in very basic terms, it tries to figure out if this is a real, for example, has a JavaScript engine and stuff like this. So very simple bots, they just look at the HTML text. They never render or download the pictures and the CSS and the JavaScript. They just look at the HTML. And a little bit more clever bots, they will also evaluate the JavaScript, but maybe they will not do certain things. Maybe they will not reach out to external network resources. And that's what happens in the challenge. And this is not visible to the user. It happens like kind of in the background. And what you can also do is you can ask for a captcha. So for example, if the page that is requested is very, I don't know, is a sensitive page, maybe the, I don't know, in cannot come up with a good idea in our scenario, but maybe in our, like if it's the free chapter of our book or something, then you could have like a captcha challenge, and then the user really has to solve a problem like a puzzle or something like this. And then this information is updated in the token, and then the request is made again, and then it is kind of, it passes through the web application firewall. And that is actually what this whole feature announcement is about. And it only works with this little cookie thing that you inject using a piece of JavaScript that you have to embed into your application. And it doesn't work for single page applications. So that's like kind of something to keep in mind. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is that it is only deployed in 5 regions. So we had US East 1, US West, and North California. I think it's US East 1, right? Then we have Ireland, Paris, and also the Sydney region. So those are the 5 regions where you can use it at the moment. So that's it. That's the feature announcement.
Okay. So do you think it makes sense to deploy that in front of Cloud on Node.io? Does it make any sense to block certain traffic to avoid costs?
I'm actually not sure if it avoids costs, because you also have to pay for this. I think it would make it harder for others to kind of copy the content. But so, for example, if you run like an Amazon.com, or we also worked with a client back then where you can like sell your used car. And they want to protect against other people kind of reading their a whole catalog of entries by just kind of browsing through the site in an automated way, and they could use it probably to protect against that. And yeah, in our case, I mean, we could try it, but I haven't checked out the pricing actually, so I forgot to do that. But I would try to do that before I enable it. Because they actually say that, and for so capture stuff and so is expensive. So what I was reading from the docs, but I haven't calculated it yet.
Okay, very cool, Michael.
All right, so the next one that I picked, and this is a really small one, but it sounds really crazy. And then I looked into the details, and then it was not so crazy anymore. So the announcement is that EC2 now enables easier patching of guest operating systems and applications with replace root volume. So basically what I was thinking is you can replace the root volume while the instance is running, right? And turns out that it's a little bit different. So what you can do is you can replace the root volume, which is, I mean, it's kind of cool. But this is in an automated way, but this automated way automatically reboots your instance. So you keep all the ABS volumes, you keep the networking config, you keep the instance store, but you don't keep the memory. So, I mean, the whole thing kind of reboots while you do it. And that's it. And that's the feature.
Wow. Okay. Sounded more amazing than I had a look at it in the first time. Okay. So, Michael, yeah. let me continue with the next one. So, I had a look into a small announcement about the Amazon Kinesis Data Streams adds capability to easily inspect data records in AWS Management Console. And actually, I thought this is really cool because that's what I was struggling when using Kinesis Data Streams for the first time. Because you're basically the data stream, you're putting your events in there, and at the beginning, you don't have a consumer or only one consumer that you're programming. And if you want to debug things, there is no easy way to read the items from the stream. So to have a user interface for that and built into the management console that you already logged in, this is really cool. So I tried it out. Right. It works. So amazing. So I got some events from our Marboard streams and tried it out. It's if you are the UI is a little strange maybe, because for example, if you decide to read the stream from the beginning, then you click show me the records and it doesn't show anything, and you have to page basically one time to show the first page coming up. So sometimes it helps to just click the next button and then the elements appear. I think that is because they're just using the API in a very raw sense and they haven't thought about the user interface at all. But yeah, it's fine. It works. I think it's helpful for Marboard to sometimes debug things on the Kinesis stream, maybe. I don't know. Could be useful. Little thing, improve things. I think especially for those who are starting out with data streams, this is cool. That's it.
The one that I was interested next is about the fault injection simulator service. And I wrote a review about that service in the past. And I basically complained that it lacks lots of capabilities. And this one is also was lacking. We can now simulate a network connectivity disruption. So this is implemented by a network access control entry. And you can block traffic either to everything, only the availability zone, to the whole VPC, to DynamoDB in S3, or to a custom prefix list. So yeah, that's basically what you can do. And I think that is kind of a good starting point. And that's it.
So the other announcement that caught my attention is AWS Apron now supports privately accessible services within Amazon VPC. So this is cool because I think, so actually the funny story is I decided to add AppRunner to our book, the Amazon Web Services in Action 3rd edition. I decided to add AppRunner as a very simple way to get started with containers on AWS. And since I wrote that chapter a few months ago, I modified it quite a lot because I had listed all the limitations of AppRunner. And now it turns out that AWS has solved most of them by shipping the missing features. So this is the last one missing. So basically what before that, AppRunner was just offering a public endpoint. So you deployed your container with your web service and you deployed it to AppRunner and you just got a public IP address or public DNS name basically, and you could access from everywhere on the internet and there was no way to restrict that. And now what we have is we have a way to only make it accessible within the VPC. And the way that works is you have to create, first of all, a VPC interface endpoint. Okay, that's what we probably assumed what we need. And then you also basically you connect the VPC endpoint with your app runner service. So you need to combine those two things to make things work. And then what you can do is from your VPC through the VPC endpoint, you're basically reaching a VPC that you don't see because it's managed by AWS in some of their accounts. And from there, the request gets routed to your container running on AppRunner. So that's basically how it works. There's even a configuration for AppRunner. You can set the so-called ingress configuration for your AppRunner service, and there you can set is public accessible to false, which means then you make sure the whole thing is really only accessible through the VPC endpoint and not through the internet. And hooray, it's also already available in CloudFormation. So we can start using that with infrastructure as code as well. One thing that I noticed, which is a little, so it's different to what AWS does with the API gateway. So with the REST API gateway, you also can configure private APIs with a VPC endpoint. There, the difference here is a little bit that this needs a VPC, the VPC endpoint does not support endpoint policies when you use AppRunner. So you cannot restrict access to this VPC endpoint based on a endpoint policy. This is a little working a little different. Also, the connection between the VPC endpoint and the AppRunner service is something I haven't seen in another service. At least I can't remember it. But yeah, I think it's cool that this is around. So for me, this is giving me the chance to try AppRunner in an enterprise environment. I think a few things are missing. As far as I've seen, there's still no SLA for the service. Otherwise, maybe I missed it, but I couldn't find anyone. So that is maybe on my list before I really would use it in production. But other than that, it's a really cool service to simplify the container workloads running in your accounts.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Do you have any other news item to share, Michael?
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. So we are through the news from the last 2 weeks, at least the ones that caught our interest. A short break. Are you looking for a new job? AWS expertise is in high demand, and here are some exciting job ads from our partners. First, our partner TechRacer is hiring cloud consultants focusing on AWS serverless development. So you should apply when you like building serverless applications with things like Lambda, TypeScript, CDK, DynamoDB, or serverless, and so on. Join TechRacer in Hanover, Duisburg, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Munich, Vienna, Lisbon, and Lucerne. Or are you into AWS, DevOps, infrastructure as code, continuous delivery? Our partner Demicon is hiring a senior lead cloud solutions architect, AWS. So Demicon is a company based in Germany, and they are remote first and hiring within the EU. You will find links to both job description in the show notes. And if you're interested, you definitely should apply today.
Okay, Andreas, that's cool. So let's go on. And I have one little story to share, or should we go into the question first? So what do you think?
Share your short story first, I would say. And then we take a look at the question.
I'm running, or we have this service or this product called Bucket AV that is basically an antivirus solution for Amazon S3. And the default option, the way it works, is that it runs on EC2 spot instances. And we always hear that spot instances, right, can be terminated at any time. So only run workloads on spot instances that can be continued on another machine, basically. And this is perfect fit for our workload because we download a file, we scan it, and then we drop the result onto an SNS topic. And if that machine goes away, we just kind of redo the file. It's not a big deal. But I was interested in how often does this actually happen that such an instance is terminated. And there are two ways to get this information. The first one is actually triggered a little bit before it actually happens, and this is called an EC2-instance rebalance recommendation. And this is used, for example, by autoscaling groups, if you configure it or if you turn the feature on, to launch new instances before the spot instance is actually terminated. So they basically try to avoid an interruption to the workload by adding instances before the other ones are kind of terminated. And what I see in a couple of regions, and this includes Ireland and US East 1, that in the last, I would say, months, these actions or these events are occurring more frequently. And the instance types that I use is M5s or T3s. And I really see this sometimes a couple of times per day. And we are not running our big fleets of instances. It's just small fleets of instances. And this is really that something that I learned is basically turn on the rebalance setting in the autoscaling group, and then monitor or kind of monitor what's going on, how often this happens. Because you can always increase the number of instance types the autoscaling group can kind of pick to launch capacity. And the more instance types you have in your pool, the more likely it can launch instances, and also the more availability zones you have in your autoscaling group. So without knowing that this is a problem, by basically monitoring it, you will not notice it. And I really just noticed this because of Marbo. This is the other product that we actually develop. Sends me Slack messages whenever that happens. And it, in the last couple of months, this really happens more or less daily. And before that, I never saw those messages. So this is something that changed. And that's what I learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. So it's actually, so as we cannot see into what's going on into the spot instances, so the only thing we have is basically look into such data, basically, to find out when things are changing. Very cool. So Michael, we have a question from Wolfgang, and he writes in and asks, what is better, AWS Code Pipeline or GitHub Actions? So yeah, very good question. So maybe Michael, let me start with some observations and then you can proceed. So I think, so we have been using AWS Code Pipeline very heavily over the past years. The main reason was that Code Pipeline offers a very easy integration with IAM. So it was very easy to get the credentials right, IAM role and stuff. But we were also observing that, first of all, the user experience is a little clumsy, because when you, for example, use GitHub and then you start a code pipeline, then you have to jump between those services to see what's happening to your deployment, or you have to log into different AWS accounts. If you deploy to multiple accounts, you have to jump around and first look at your pipeline, then look to the account where you are deploying to. So the user experience for a developer is not too impressive, actually. And the other thing is that we are noticing that Code Pipeline, especially when you're using it together with Code Build, is relatively slow, because spinning up those Code Build actions takes some time because of the overhead of starting the container every time for each of those tasks. So I think that one big difference between those two is the user experience for the developers is, I would say, better with GitHub, especially, of course, if you're using GitHub as your code repositories. And the other thing, I think the reason that GitHub Actions is interesting is because it's running on one node. Basically, the whole pipeline runs on one node, or at least, it's not 100% true, but more part of the pipeline run on the same node, and that's less handoff between different steps. Do you have something to add?
Yeah, so maybe the limitations that we figured out already is, like, one thing that we kind of missed is the manual approval step that we have in Code Pipeline, and it is available in GitHub Actions, but it basically uses a feature called environments, and you can, for each environment, you can have different kind of reviewers. And then you can wait for this in your GitHub action or in your workflow. But this requires an enterprise plan, And we don't have an enterprise plan.
I think the other thing that that you found out, Michael, is the thing about parallelization. So
oh, yeah.
Running steps in parallel.
Oh yeah, that's right. So in code pipeline, what you can do basically by default, if all the actions run in on the same run order, which is a number, then they will execute in parallel. And in GitHub Actions, things are a little bit different. So jobs run in parallel by default, but you can have dependencies, and all the steps in the job run in sequence. So if you, for example, have, if you use the official AWS action for deploying CloudFormation stacks, you will have one step per stack. And then this will just like one stack after each other will be deployed if you run it in the same job. I mean, you could, in theory, have multiple jobs and then kind of, but it gets very complicated to make this parallel, basically, because you also have to take care of the input and stuff like this. So this is a little bit more complicated. But what I did for, because the CloudFormation stack deployment was the biggest pain point for us because it was not running in parallel. So I just forked the action from AWS. And this is, by the way, kind of unmaintained anyway, so the repo is archived and it throws lots of deprecation warnings. So I forked that and I just added the capability that you can deploy stacks in parallel. So now you can have multiple stacks in one action, basically. Multiple stacks in one action, and then it, you know, it just works in the same way as code pipeline, and it is not a problem anymore.
Very good. Yeah. So I think this is a good summary. I've pasted the link to your blog post to the show notes and to the chat as well.
Great.
So you've written about that in more detail. So I think that helps. And yeah, Wolfgang writes, he finds code pipeline harder because of the buckets between the stages. So basically, yeah, code pipeline hands over the state by using an S3 bucket. Hands it over from step to step or from action to action. Yeah, and it's that's correct. It's sometimes a little tricky to debug things when you're looking into the artifacts from one stage to the other. Yeah.
I mean, definitely GitHub Actions is easier to use. So, I mean, that's
so I think the whole user experience is definitely a good argument. Okay, thank you for this question. If you have questions, send them over during the week. Ask CloudOnNaut or reach us via Twitter, in the comments, on LinkedIn, wherever you can find us. Send us your questions. We'll have to answer them next week. So yeah, that's it. We'll be back next week. Subscribe to the CloudOnNaut newsletter or our podcast or the YouTube channel to make sure you do not miss the upcoming shows. Also, we want to thank our supporters who make this show possible, and please consider supporting our work with a recurring or one-time donation as well. You will find details and links to all of that in the show notes. So thanks a lot for listening and watching. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.